I Hate the News is the weekly news bulletin from I Hate Politics podcast, a show about a human activity we love to hate. I am Sunil Dasgupta. Today is November 5th, 2024, Election Day. We are all cynical enough to recall that every election is the most important one. But rarely have we had democracy on the ballot in the way it is today. About 40% of voters across the country, as well as in the DC metropolitan area we primarily serve, have already voted. We have the numbers and instructions on provisional voting in Maryland. The law might differ in other states, but always ask, and you should be able to vote provisionally if you need it. And in the politics is strange department. Left-oriented nonprofits send out a mailer in Maryland, leading the state's attorney to issue a cease and desist letter. We have the backstory. And strangest of all, white supremacist Nick Fuentes breaks from Trump, and another, Richard Spencer, comes out in outright support of Harris. Does this signal the beginning of the end of the Trump coalition? And more. Stay with us. Especially if you're standing in line at a polling place and listening to this podcast.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program. If your goal is to make a meaningful impact with a career in local, state, or federal government, discover what this degree can do for you. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society functioning precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaricino on guitar and vocals, Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals, Evan Hurd on bass, and Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends. Gilberto Zelaya, welcome back to your tired body.
Hello, my friend. Hello.
What's the numbers? Early voting has ended, and mail-in ballots are being sent in. So what's going on?
Yes. So over the last 8 days, from the 24th through the 31st of October, almost 165,000 Montgomery County registered voters showed up and voted early. So great work, guys. Right now, of those individuals, we also have over 191,000 Montgomery County voters desiring to vote by mail. And out of those, we have over 121,000 mail-in ballots received at the office, which means that we have about 70,000 mail-in ballots circulating somewhere or resting on someone's dinner table or coffee table. So, you know, high level, straight to the point. If you change your mind and you want to vote in person on Election Day, even if you bring your mail-in ballot, an unvoted ballot with all the bells and whistles, the envelope, et cetera, you're going to have to vote provisionally because your voter record will state, when we look you up, requested to vote by mail. So follow through with that intention, because you're just going to add additional time at the polls. There's paperwork you have to fill out. There's a rationale that the chief judge, the provisional judge, has to fill out. So you're just adding time to your voting experience. So get that pen, circle them bubbles. Identify the closest drop box, text the word box and your zip code to 77788. Get that done before the 5th of November. Listen, post offices close at 5. So if you're going to drop your mail-in ballot at the corner of Georgia or at your neighborhood mailbox, the post office is going to pick that up on the 6th of November, and it's not going to be counted, and it's not going to be incorporated into our canvas because it's just late.
Every high school in Montgomery County has a drop box, right?
Pretty much, yes. So we have 58, predominantly the high schools, community centers. You probably drive a handful on the way to work. They're everywhere. They're accessible. We have bipartisan Dropbox attendants that are visiting each box to retrieve those mail-in ballots twice a day. And so we want to ensure that your mail-in ballot is secure. But, you know, the sooner you send it to us, the quicker we can start processing, checking if there's a signature on the voter oath, because otherwise, if it does not have your signature, it's not going to be incorporated into the canvas and it's not going to be counted. And you're going to give us the administrative burden falls on us now, because now we have to hunt you down to get a signature.
Roughly 255,000 Montgomery County voters have requested for mail-in ballots or voted early. That's almost 40%. So 60% of folks are still planning on voting now.
The doors open at 7. They close at 8. If you jump in line before 8 p.m., you will get to vote. If you'd like to wait on lines at Disney, then that's your cup of tea. That's fine. But, you know, the peak times, you know, think of the peak times. But be patient, be grateful, be courteous to our election workers. They're our voters, too. They're your neighbors, and they're there to serve. So be considerate of their needs. They've been there for 14, 15 hours. When you show up late, if you need to ascertain the location, grab your sample ballot. On the back of your sample ballot is the location where we would like for you to vote on election day. If you don't have your sample ballot, you could text the word check to 77788 to ascertain where you should present yourself on election day. And if for whatever reason you're running late, you just can't make it to your corresponding election day polling place, find the nearest polling place, but you will need to vote a provisional ballot because you're out of district.
What documentation do they need for the provisional ballot?
So it's you know, it's good practice to carry your driver's license, permit, ID, etc. You know, so your name, residential address, date of birth, etc. It's a standard application. If for whatever reason you're truly not registered to vote, you don't meet the same day voter registration guidelines, you know, you'll be ready to vote in 2026. But we will do everything in our power to ensure that we will accept your provisional ballots. But be prepared if you have to vote provisionally to add additional time to your voting experience on election day.
Gilberto Zelaya, thank you and good luck.
My pleasure. Make a vote plan. See you on the 5th.
One of the stranger things to happen last week in Maryland's campaign season were mailers sent by the voter engagement nonprofit called Voter Participation Center, which included the recipient voting history, the voting histories of their neighbors, and a promise to follow up after the election to check in on the vote. The mailer was called Creepy, and Maryland residents complained to the State Board of Elections, and the Maryland Attorney General, Anthony Brown, sent a cease and desist notice to the Voter Participation Center, where he described the mailer as threatening and intimidation. In response, the Voter Participation Center's lawyer wrote to the Attorney General saying that these mailers were legal and constitutional. Whether or not a person has voted is public information and widely used in campaigns. The Voter Participation Center has rejected the argument that the message was intimidating. Sasha Eisenberg is a journalist and author who first wrote about these types of mailers in his book on campaign innovation called The Victory Lab, which was published in 2012, 10 years ago.
Around the turn of the century, a couple of professors at Yale who decide to run a field experiment testing door knocks and direct mailers inspires just a massive interest in this sort of empirical study of what works and what doesn't, particularly focused on turnout. Because it's very difficult to measure a change in a voter's opinion. It is pretty straightforward to measure a voter's change in behavior. We have publicly available voter records. And so if you randomize mail, a door knock, a phone call to voters and you treat it basically like it's a drug trial, you can figure out, you can go back after the election and see whether the thing you did had a measurable impact on the treatment group relative to a control group. Hundreds, if not thousands, of experiments were done by people in academia, people inside campaigns, people in the nonprofit world, many of which were focused on how to turn a non-voter into a voter. And the Voter Participation Center is a nonprofit that exists basically to turn out people who, and they are very particular about how they say this for tax reasons, because they are not officially partisan, but basically they're trying to turn out the type of people who vote for Democrats. And they are funded by the type of people who want to see Democrats win. And what they have found is that the traditional get out the vote messaging, which would give people information like about, it's important to vote for our party because we'll do better on this or that issue. That's not what's stopping non-voters from voting. Is it more information about the candidates or the parties? And that the traditional sort of League of Women Voters style messaging, which was voter turnout is always going down. Don't be part of this problem. Please be a good citizen. Do the right thing. Go out and vote. It's terrible messaging. You're telling people that their peers are not voting and that they should go in the opposite direction. All the research has pointed to the idea that if you make people conscious about their self-esteem, being seen as a voter, wanting to be a good citizen, that if you let them know that other people around them are voting, are participating in this, that they are more likely to want to participate. And so this is one of the most effective tactics that we've seen. It's one, letting people know that the people around them are voters, but also letting them know that they can be judged. We have a secret ballot in this country. Nobody knows for whom you vote, but we do know if you voted. And the idea is that you can be judged by your neighbors or by people in the political world as a good citizen or a bad citizen, depending on your behavior.
When is it that they figured out that this particular kind of language works?
So 2006, there was a sort of seminal experiment that was done in Michigan by a local direct mail vendor, a data guy named Mark Grebner, who wanted to play with some of this research. And he sent out a mailer. This was before, I believe, a gubernatorial primary in Michigan that said to voters, here's your vote history. You did not vote in the 2004 primary. You voted in the 2004 general election. You did vote in the 2005 school bond referendum. You did not vote in the 2006 primary. And here are your neighbors' vote histories. And it took a handful of people with close street addresses. And then it said, after the, you know, another election is coming up on Tuesday, whatever, after the election, we'll send up an up. We'll send out an updated set to everyone. Two things happened afterwards. One, it was the largest measured increase in turnout of any of these experiments that had been done. And also the guy who sent it, this guy, Mark Grebner, started getting death threats. And those two things, I think, let him know he was onto something, which was that this was a really potent tool. I think because it disrupted the understanding of what's public and private. And so I think people are inclined because of the secret ballot to think of voting as this private act, but receiving a piece of mail like this, there is something creepy about it. If for the first time you're being told that something you thought was private is actually public and can be understood in a social situation, that's creepy. But it's also potent because somebody who's not voted, you need to dramatically disrupt either their knowledge base about how elections work or their psychology about how and why they don't vote. It's not a secret anymore. It got published, I believe, 2008 in American Political Science Review or one of the major journals. Folks on the left picked up on using it first, but now Republican groups use it as frequently. Groups have tried to figure out how to channel the power of these mailers with the desire not to get the backlash to the sender. And one of the things is don't put your name on the return address, which is why you have Center for Voter Information, which sounds official, but it doesn't say progressives for a, you know, left-leaning majority or something. And so you tend to have super PACs or outside groups doing this where they don't have a public figure instead of having Kamala Harris or Donald Trump as a return address because they don't want to be seen doing something creepy. What's news, I think, in Maryland is that at this date, the attorney general's office is acting like this is a new, it may be creepy, but it's not a sort of novel, untested intrusion into the way politics is practiced.
Have political experiments gone wrong sometimes? Could it be that they have overstepped?
One thing we've seen is that the power of them decreases over time, the social pressure. When you get this message for the first time, it's shocking. Oh my God, they know whether or not I voted. They're going to tell my neighbors. It's creepy. The second, fourth, 20th time you get it, not so creepy. Like you've priced in the idea that this is public. And so there's a kind of, you know, potential shock factor with some of these that just naturally decays over time. And And so people don't see this as kind of a silver bullet anymore, in part because their fear is it's been so overused that it's lost the ability to really get voters' attention. Now, on the ethical side, I mean, I think there are people who think that this goes too far. And certainly, you know, as I suggested, a lot of candidate campaigns don't do this type of mail because they don't want to be held accountable for how people respond. A couple things I'd point out. One, you send it to the people who are already on your side. There's some sense that you're not maybe losing as much vote because you're not sending it to people who are persuadable. People wrestle with this less, I think, from an ethical perspective. These are public records. There are no limitation on using them. It's been a blind spot of voters probably not to recognize that campaigns have been using these types of records to make decisions about whether to contact you for years. You know, when like Paul Sarbanes sent you a piece of mail, or like, you know, Michael Steele sent a canvasser to knock on your door. They were using the exact same database to make decisions about whether to call you, when to call you, what to say, what they infer about your political identity. They just pretended it was an accident. Those people knocking on your door during dinner, it's not an accident. They are making a decision to contact you because they know things about you, your political behavior, and inferred things about your political opinion, and have decided that it fits into their strategy to engage with you in this way at this time.
Sasha Eisenberg, thank you so much for explaining the creepiest mailer received in Maryland this election season.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
To complete the story, little is likely to come from the cease and desist letter now. The Voter Participation Center is a nonprofit with a nonpartisan voter engagement mission, largely funded from the left, where the belief is that encouraging voter turnout generally is beneficial to the Democratic Party. Those complaining about the social pressure mailers in Maryland were all Democrats, and the Attorney General himself is a Democrat. So the disagreement over the mailers were in fact an internecine argument over how to boost voter turnout. Because Maryland has been so overwhelmingly Democratic, the state has been slow to see political campaign innovations. But this time, the Alsobrooks Hogan race likely prompted those letters. Few things, however, are stranger than the next story. White supremacist and neo-Nazi provocateurs Nick Fuentes and Richard Spencer appear to have broken with Trump. With 3 days to go, Fuentes complained on Twitter that Trump's campaign was being taken over by billionaires. And Spencer, one of the architects of the 2017 Unite the Right rally, of which Trump said that there were good people on both sides, says that Trump would abandon Ukraine if elected, and that Harris represents a more acceptable choice as president. We often talk about the horseshoe effect in politics, where extremes from both ends of the political spectrum meet. But this is not what's happening here. Harris and the Democrats have not become more extreme. Instead, they have moderated and moved to the center. And Spencer specifically recognizes this shift. The world of white supremacy is murky, and there are layers upon layers that will take time to unpeel. What is immediately interesting about this development is the seeming disintegration of the Trump coalition, which at one time included both Fuentes and Spencer. In Spencer's case, it is interesting as well to see the subsumation of his primary complaint about race mixing to grand foreign policy goals. In Fuentes' case, it is a subsumation of race over oligarchic power. Trump may yet bring the white supremacists back into his coalition, but only if he prevails on election day. That, as of this morning, is looking increasingly unlikely. In very local news, the first action under Governor Moore's new rental housing bill, the Tenant Safety Act, has seen 39 tenants in Prince George's County come together to file a class action lawsuit against their landlord. The tenant safety law allows these cases to be bundled and therefore allow tenants to be better represented in courts, improving their chances of success against the landlord. The courts have not yet spoken, but we will be following closely. Sit down. That's all for this episode. Be sure to check out our feature interview series that comes out Friday mornings. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer Adama Gay, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaricino on guitar and vocals. Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals. Evan Hurd on bass. And Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends.